Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, Christopher Jones Cruz brings us a report on the island nation of Barbados. Here now is Christopher Jones Cruz.
The Prime Minister of Barbados wants Britain's Queen Elizabeth II to be removed as the nation's head of state. Frindall Stewart says he wants his country to become a parliamentary republic. A parliamentary republic is a system in which the people choose a legislature, which then chooses the leaders of the government, the executive branch. In other words, the legislative and executive branches of government are not separate, as they are in the United States. About 50 countries use this system of governance. Stewart wants the change to take effect on November 30, 2016, the 50th anniversary of his country's independence from Britain. He told a recent meeting of the ruling Democratic Labour Party that it's a little awkward in the year 2015 to still have to stand up and, instead of pledging allegiance to Barbados, to be pledging allegiance to Her Majesty the Queen. He says it does not make sense for the British monarch to be head of state of an independent country. The DLP holds a majority of the seats in the House of Assembly, the lower house of the Barbadian Parliament. But two-thirds of the House and Senate must agree if a change is to be made to the Constitution, which now names the British monarch as head of state. So the Prime Minister will need to gain the support of the opposition if his plan is to gain approval. Barbados historian Trevor Marshall welcomed the Prime Minister's announcement. He says there is nothing to be gained by having a monarch as head of state. But not all Bajans, as residents of Barbados are called, support the change. One person wrote in the comments section of a newspaper that the people of Barbados don't consider this an important issue now and don't want the Constitution to be changed. The Associated Press reports the debate has split older and younger Bajans for many years. The news agency reports older islanders see the Queen as a symbol of stability, while many young Bajans see the Queen as an anachronism, a person or thing that seems to belong to the past and does not fit in the present. Even though the British monarch is the head of state of Barbados, citizens and their representatives have at least partly decided their own laws for hundreds of years. And they have fully decided their laws since all adults were given the right to vote in the early 1950s. Barbados was officially under British rule until 1961 and gained full independence in 1966. A Governor General named by the Queen represents the monarch in Barbados. His or her role is mostly ceremonial. The Governor General is named with the approval of the country's Prime Minister. Queen Elizabeth has not been to Barbados for 26 years. when she visits the country, she does so as the Queen of Barbados, her official title there. A spokesman for the Queen said the decision about becoming a republic is a matter for the government and people of Barbados. British explorers discovered Barbados in the early 1600s. Many Caribbean islands have been under the control of the Spanish, British, Dutch, and French at different times beginning in the 1600s. But Barbados has remained under British control almost continuously from the time it was discovered by British explorers until gaining independence. So it has closer ties to England than do many of Britain's former colonies. Barbados is often called the Jewel of the Caribbean and Little England. As in Britain, people drive their cars on the left side of the road. Also like in Britain, the sports of polo and cricket are very popular in Barbados. Many Britons visit Barbados regularly, and many of them own homes there. Large passenger planes full of travelers arrive in Barbados daily from Britain, the United States, and many other countries. The debate about whether the country should become a parliamentary republic is similar to those that have taken place in other countries that were once part of the British Empire and retained the Queen as their head of state after they gained independence. Barbados has considered becoming a parliamentary republic since at least the late 1970s. In recent years, it has taken steps to create an identity separate from Britain. In 2005, it decided that the Caribbean Court of Justice would be its final court of appeal. Before then, it had used the Privy Council in London as its Supreme Court. The Council has long served as the High Court for many former British colonies. Even if Queen Elizabeth is removed as the head of state of Barbados, the country would continue to be a member of the Commonwealth of Nations. The Commonwealth is a group of more than 50 countries, most of which were once British colonies. More than 30 of them are republics. The National Post newspaper says if Barbados removes Elizabeth as head of state, it will become the 16th member of the British Commonwealth to do so since she became queen in 1953. The British monarch is no longer head of state of Pakistan, South Africa, and Kenya. The Caribbean nations of Dominica and Trinidad became republics in the late 1970s. Fiji did so in 1987. The last country to remove the Queen as head of state was Mauritius in 1992. For now, the Queen remains head of state of 16 countries, including the Caribbean countries of Bahamas, Grenada, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Australia, New Zealand, Belize, and Canada. Canada has sometimes considered removing the Queen as its head of state. In May, a public opinion study found 39% of Canadians asked want the country to become a republic when the Queen dies. The National Post newspaper reports that in 1999, 55% of voters in Australia rejected a plan for the country to become a republic, and 65% of those who voted in a referendum in Tuvalu in 2008 said they wanted the Queen to remain their head of state. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Even in the world of medicine, what is old is new again. Thousands of years ago, Egyptians used it to sterilize drinking water. Ancient Romans, Aztecs, and Greeks also used it for medical treatments. I am talking about copper. The symbol for copper on the periodic chart for elements is Cu. If we are talking about germs, that might mean see you later. Copper kills many germs on contact. Now it is back in hospitals to do just that. One of the major ways we get sick is we touch surfaces out in the world, many made of metal or plastic. These surfaces are covered with germs. Germs live on poles on a train or bus. They are found on doorknobs and handles. This is especially true in hospitals. Bill Keeville is a microbiologist at Southampton University in Britain. He is investigating the properties of copper that kill germs, or as researchers call them, pathogens. Keevil points to studies that compare infection rates at U.S. hospitals that use copper surfaces and those that do not.
They found that copper alloys gave a 58% reduction in infection rate. So that showed, you know, that in the real world of a hospital environment, that copper alloys do a great job.
In a study published in the journal MBio, Keevil and his team found that copper surfaces can quickly kill the coronavirus 229E. You may not know coronavirus 229E by name, but if you ever have had a common cold, or the more serious pneumonia, you have been in contact with it. The coronavirus 229E is also closely related to the pathogen that causes SARS and MERS. Keevil explains that copper ions, electrically charged molecules, kill dangerous viruses by destroying their genetic material. Copper ions do this by interacting with oxygen and changing the oxygen molecules. As a result, the virus cells cannot mutate.
Now, these ions are able to punch holes in the cell's membrane, enter the cell and destroy the nucleic acid. So they're completely killed. There's no chance of mutation leading to resistance, and there's no coming back. So the chemistry is fantastic.
Keevil notes that ancient civilizations knew about the germ-killing properties of copper. However, they may not have understood the science behind it. Researchers at the U.S. National Institutes of Health wrote on their website about the oldest recorded medical use of copper. They say its use is noted in an Egyptian medical book written about 4,000 years ago. The book describes how they used copper to sterilize wounds and drinking water. Keevil says earlier generations of builders in the United States also knew this about copper. That is why copper alloys, such as brass, were often used in building materials. But modern builders stopped using copper and copper alloys. They cost more than other building materials. However, Bill Keevil says copper could save hospitals money. He says their costs of fighting infections will drop, including drugs for treatment. More importantly, less people will get sick. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The war between the United States and Spain in 1898 was one of the shortest in American history. The fighting lasted about 3 months. Yet that short war led to long-term changes for America. Victory made the United States an increasingly important world power. This week in our series, Larry West and Shep O'Neill tell about those developments.
The United States received several of Spain's island colonies as part of the peace agreement. The most important was the Philippines. Many Americans thought the United States should not have overseas territories. But President William McKinley thought the Philippines were unprepared for independence. He decided to keep the islands and prepare the people for self-government in the future. A Filipino nationalist group, led by Emilio Aguinaldo, rejected American control. Aguinaldo declared the formation of a Philippine Republic, and he started a guerrilla war against the occupying forces.
The rebellion in the Philippines became a major issue in America's presidential election of 1900. The Republican Party renominated William McKinley as president. And it nominated a hero of the Spanish-American War, New York Governor Theodore Roosevelt, as vice president. The Democratic Party, for the second time, nominated Congressman William Jennings Bryan as president. It nominated a former vice president, Adlai Stevenson, as vice president again.
William Jennings Bryan campaigned against the American takeover of the Philippines. He received support from a new group, the Anti-Imperialist League. Members included leading American politicians, businessmen, and writers. President McKinley did not campaign much. He let vice presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt do it. Roosevelt spoke of America's success as a new economic and political power in the world. He said the Republican Party was responsible. The majority of voters liked what Roosevelt said. They elected the Republican candidates.
The Republican victory destroyed the hopes of many nationalists in the Philippines. With William McKinley in the White House again, they saw little chance of gaining independence. Nationalist leader Emilio Aguinaldo, however, refused to surrender. As long as he remained free, the guerrilla war would continue. 4 months, American forces tried without success to find him. Finally, with the help of a tribe of Filipino mercenary soldiers called the Macabebe Scouts, they captured him. Aguinaldo signed an agreement to support the United States. With this agreement, the rebellion ended on the island of Luzon, but It continued for more than a year in the southern Philippines. Hostilities ended officially on July 4, 1902.
American occupation of the Philippines made the United States a major power in the Far East. As such, it began to develop new policies toward Asia, especially a new policy toward China. Americans had been trading with China for years, but not heavily. As the American economy grew, however, businessmen saw China, with a population of 400 million people, as a great market for American products. Other countries were interested in this market, too. Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and Russia all claimed special rights in parts of China. They began to divide the country into areas called spheres of influence. It seemed these areas could become foreign colonies. Then the United States would be cut off from trading directly with China. To prevent that from happening, American Secretary of State John Hay proposed what became known as the Open Door Policy.
Secretary Hay asked the nations involved to agree to equal trading rights for all countries in all parts of China. No nation, he said, should interfere with the rights or powers of any other nation in China. No one welcomed the proposal, but no one rejected it either. Most of the nations involved said they agreed with the idea, but they said they could not approve it unless everyone else did. Secretary Hay refused to wait for them to act. So in May 1900, he announced that all the nations involved had given their approval to the Open Door Policy. The new policy was tested very soon. Within a month of Hay's announcement, violence broke out against foreigners in China.
The attacks were led by a secret group called Righteous Harmonious Fists. Foreigners called its members Boxers. Boxers hated all foreign influence in China. They organized in areas where foreign influence was strongest. They killed Christian missionaries and Chinese who had accepted the Christian religion. They also destroyed foreign industries, especially railroads. The Chinese government in Beijing supported the Boxer Rebellion. It permitted the Boxers to occupy the capital. The rebellion lasted about 2 months. It ended when an allied force of American, British, French, German, and Japanese soldiers reached Beijing and ended the Boxer occupation.
The foreign powers began to negotiate with China on paying for damages. The United States was worried about the results. It believed some of the nations involved would use the Boxer Rebellion as a way to gain more control over Chinese territory. Secretary of State Hay quickly announced America's policy on the issue. The United States, he said, wanted a settlement which would bring peace and safety to China. The settlement must protect China's territorial rights so it would not be divided into foreign colonies. Britain and Germany agreed. With their help, Secretary Hay got the others to accept money, not territory, as payment for damages. The final settlement forced China to pay $333 million. The United States used some of its share to pay for the education of Chinese students in America.
The results of the Boxer Rebellion and the Spanish-American War made clear that the new century would have a new world power, the United States. And this new power had a president with the political skills to do the job, William McKinley. In September 1901, President McKinley made a major foreign policy speech at the Pan American Fair in Buffalo, New York. He spoke about the importance and the promise of America's new position in the world. The next day, President McKinley went to the fair's Temple of Music. He planned to spend several hours meeting the public and shaking hands.
A young man waited in line to see him. When the young man stepped in front of McKinley, McKinley reached out to shake his hand. Two shots rang out from a gun the man had hidden under a cloth. One of the bullets struck McKinley in the stomach. The president was taken to an emergency hospital on the fairgrounds. He was not conscious. The bullet had damaged his stomach, pancreas, and one kidney, but doctors did not believe he was in danger of dying.
The man who shot McKinley was Leon Czolgosz. Czolgosz was an anarchist. He believed all rulers were enemies of the people. He believed the people had the right to kill them. Czolgosz also was mentally ill. He had tried to join several anarchist groups. They refused to accept him, however, because of his mental condition. After shooting President McKinley, Czolgosz explained why he had done it. He said it was not right for one man to receive so much public honor, while he received none.
For 2 days, the president remained in a coma. Then his condition changed. He regained consciousness and was able to talk. He rested and became stronger. Then the president's condition changed again. An infection developed in his wound. It spread throughout his body. In another few days, he was dead.
Vice President Roosevelt hurried to Buffalo. He went to the house where the president's body lay. Then he went to another house to be sworn in as president. He was 42 years old, the youngest man ever to hold the office. Roosevelt declared that the administration would go on as before. "It is my aim," he said, "to continue unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace, the prosperity, and the honor of our beloved country."
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Shep O'Neill. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.